From Maryland to South Dakota, California to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, was the election of Donald Trump a fluke or a fundamental shift in the electorate? Selena Zito and Brad Todd, authors of the new book, The Great Revolt, are here with the answer. The blue wave is not likely to wash Republicans out of their U.S. Senate majority. Daily Caller columnist Keith Naughton handicaps the races. Free trade is not just an economic issue, it is also a moral issue. Ian Murray of the Competitive Enterprise Institute tells Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine why. And do you own your home or just rent it from the government? Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has an American Radio Journal commentary on the negative effect of property taxes. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The election of Donald Trump to the presidency came as a surprise to many, but in their book, The Great Revolt, authors Selena Zito and Brad Todd explain why it was the ultimate manifestation of a populist revolt that had been brewing for years. Selena and Brad, welcome to American Radio Journal. Selena and Brad, before we get into some of the individual stories that you talk about in your book, and there are a lot of them, and they are very interesting and compelling, each in their own right. But when we look back at the 2016 presidential election, a lot of people are scratching their heads and saying, what the heck happened and why? And you explain that in the book. So give us your take on that.
When Brad and I decided to do this book, our belief was, or our thought process going into this, is was it a fluke or is this a realignment? And we concluded that, you know, this is a new populist coalition within the Republican Party, and that while Trump was the result of it, he did not cause it. And so what the heck happened had been happening for a long time. It has, the parties have, this just didn't happen in 2016. We had been building to this for years, not just in politics, but also in culture. Both of those sort of infused together to bring these, like a variety of different archetypes of voters together to elect Trump to president.
Brad, how did the normal Republican coalition get changed by this election? Donald Trump lost some voters that traditionally had voted Republican, but then he obviously brought new people into the mix. So what was the makeup of that change?
We think there are two groups of swing voters. One of them is our suburban voters, tend to be suburban voters in highly educated neighborhoods who have long voted on issues like taxes and budgeting and foreign policy and crime control, and sort of have agreed with Republicans on most things but didn't like Donald Trump personally. And then the other group of swing voters are voters who are less conservative on economics but plenty conservative on culture, but who have been Democrats for most of their lives and sort of sought to vote for Democrats when they could. Many of these were labor Democrats or the children of labor Democrats. Those voters were particularly important in the Great Lakes states, helping Donald Trump win an electoral college majority. And so those two groups of swing voters we see now as sort of the groups to watch. Trump was able to win the presidential election with fewer of the first group because he got more of the second group. And in many ways, he broadened the Republican coalition because most of those suburban voters in 2016 still voted Republican for Senate and House. We'll see if they do this year or not. But Donald Trump basically didn't get votes he didn't need from those voters, and he got some that he couldn't spare in the other group.
During the 2016 campaign, Selena, you spent a lot of time traveling around the country interviewing voters, and in your book, The Great Revolt, that you and Brad have written, you tell the story of the campaign through the eyes of these individual voters. Can you share with us at least one example of somebody you interviewed that gave you a tip-off as to where the country was heading in the last election?
Well, I can remember being in Youngstown, Ohio, at a rally for Donald Trump. This was probably, okay, he went there several times. I think this was maybe July. And I went to this event and I saw a variety of different, I went a couple hours early to get a feel for it. And I saw a variety of different types of voters that you typically would not see at a Republican presidential event. And these people were really, really excited. And there was one gentleman who was there with his daughter. His name was Frank Bellamy. He said, I believe he had 11 children. He was African-American. He was with, he only had one of his children. And he had worked his way up in life and said he had several different financial setbacks, but was on his feet now and had his own small business. And he noted that he saw a kinship and felt a kinship in Trump in how he, you know, sort of fought back against the establishment in both parties. And Frank had been a lifelong Democrat. And I saw him in him what ends up becoming one of our chapters in our one of our archetypes in the book, The Rough Rebounders. Someone who you wouldn't expect to have a kinship with Donald Trump, but was telling their saw their life through him and saw that he would do something different in Washington. He didn't expect him to be perfect. He sort of expected him to be like, I think his quote was, he's going to be like a bowling ball in a China factory. He's just going to be breaking things all over the place. But that's sort of what I'm looking for. And that moment right there, and this was July of 2016, I understood that something very different was going to happen. And there were a lot of voters that pundits and pollsters and strategists were missing because they placed voters in specific kind of models to turn out. And these voters were very willing to break those models.
Brett, as we look now to the midterm elections, of course, the subtitle of your book is Inside the Populist Coalition, Reshaping American Politics. We have found that one sort of area, one geographic area around the country where President Trump did not perform well and where the resistance of the left appears to be the strongest are in suburbs around larger cities. Of course, a lot of congressional districts are highly competitive in those areas. What does this mean for the upcoming midterms? Are Republicans going to be able to hold Congress? And if we have a blue wave, how does that impact this great revolt that's taking place?
Well, those two groups of swing voters we just talked about really play a role in one of the two chambers this year. The suburban voters where Donald Trump struggled, but they've typically been Republicans most of their life, those voters are very key on the House battlefield this year. You have a ton of House races sitting in sort of high-density suburbs. Hillary Clinton won 23 districts that Republicans currently hold in the U.S. House. The Democrats need 24 to take over. That, I think, the Republicans' ability to retain those suburban voters in spite of those voters' mixed reviews of Donald Trump is a key to whether Republicans keep the House or not. But in the Senate, it's those industrial and rural and ex-urban voters who have always voted Democrat, who are culturally conservative but not economically conservative, sort of the Trump pioneers, if you will, that came over to Trump, which we profile in three or four different archetypes in the book. Those voters hold the key to the Senate map because Democrats currently control 10 seats that are on the ballot this year in states that Donald Trump won in the Senate. So if Republicans can turn out those Trump pioneer voters, voters who typically vote Democrat but voted for Trump to vote for their candidates for the Senate this year, you'll see Republican gains in the Senate. But if they can't hold on to the suburban upscale, upper income, two college degree voters in the burbs, then they'll lose the House.
Selena, when it comes to these Trump voters, and as you've pointed out, a number of them non-traditional, are they pleased with what the president's been doing? Is the base holding?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, Brad and I often have this conversation that it is still, every morning we still wake up and it's November 9th, 2016, about 2 o'clock in the morning. And if you're a Trump supporter, you're incredibly happy and optimistic about what the president is going to do. If you didn't vote for him, you're still mad and you still think Russia had something to do with him winning. And not much has changed.
The book again is The Great Revolt, Inside the Populist Coalition Reshaping American Politics, written by our guests today, Selena Zito and Brad Todd. And Selena and Brad, is there a website where folks can read more about the book, perhaps order it? Where can they get it?
GreatRevolt.com. No, just GreatRevolt.com. You can find links to buy it on IndieBound or from an independent store near you, or Barnes & Noble or Amazon or Books A Million.
Brad Todd and Selena Zito, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having us.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth is on vacation this week, and we are, however, going to talk about key U.S. Senate races around the country, and we're going to do that with Keith Naughton, who is with Silent Majority Strategies. His column appears frequently in the Daily Caller. Keith, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Let's start out. Give us an overview. We have talked about U.S. Senate races on this program, but for those who maybe didn't hear it or don't remember, what is the lay of the land? Republicans have a very, very slim majority in the U.S. Senate. Who's up, and which party benefits from the electoral map this year?
Republicans do have a 51-49 advantage. However, in this midterm election, they're only defending 9 seats, whereas the Democrats are defending 24. So even though parties who have the White House tend to do poorly in midterm elections, the math doesn't work very well for the Democrats. Ironically, the Republicans are in a better position to pick up seats, not necessarily many seats, but they're in a better position to gain seats in this midterm than the Democrats.
Typically, Keith, is it not normal for the party of a new president to lose seats in this first midterm? But also, we do have an economy that has really taken off, which tends to benefit the party in power. So do you see either one of those trends dominating, or is this more a situation that's going to be fought out based on personalities and situations in each individual state?
Those dynamics tend to play out more strongly on the House side. On the Senate side, in a president's first midterm, his party typically only loses one seat on average going back to 1946. And this has to do with the fact that this set of senators was elected 6 years prior. So they weren't elected in a similar cycle as the president. So the lay of the land is a little bit out of sync as you go into the first midterm. The second midterm is when presidents tend to lose a larger number of senators. Now, the economy is helpful to Republicans, but these races tend to turn more specifically on a state-by-state basis.
Let's talk about state-by-state. We have a third of the Senate up. Which states are going to be battleground states this year, and which ones do we have situations where Republicans have a pickup opportunity because it's either an open seat or a weak Democrat incumbent, and vice versa? Are there seats where Democrats might be able to pick up a Republican seat?
Well, there are really 7 main competitive seats and 2 that are sort of outside on the periphery. The main chances for the Democrats are in Arizona, Nevada, and Tennessee, which Arizona and Tennessee are open seats. Nevada is occupied by Republican Senator Heller. And the Republicans' best chances are in Florida, North Dakota, Missouri, and Indiana, all of which have Democratic incumbents. The 2 sort of outside seats that are hanging out on the periphery, Montana and West Virginia, are also occupied by incumbent Democrats who have leads. They're not overwhelming leads, so it's not out of the realm of possibility that those seats might become competitive.
When we look at Tennessee, Keith, you have, as you've mentioned, an open seat. Tennessee's generally been a reliable red seat. Why is it that this seat is in play? Isn't this is sort of an odd place for an in-play seat?
Well, it's been viewed in play up until this point. I mean, they just had their primary last week, and the Democrats nominated Phil Bredesen, who was a very popular governor, kind of a middle-of-the-road Democrat, probably their best possible candidate, and the Republicans didn't have a candidate. They were going through a somewhat difficult primary. Now that Marsha Blackburn has been nominated, the first poll that's come out has put her 4 points ahead of Bredesen, who up until this point had been leading any of the individual Republicans. So I think you call Tennessee as something that is competitive that the Democrats might have a chance at. I think if the polls keep coming out showing Blackburn in a lead, we might soon take that off the map.
What about nearby Missouri? Missouri is a state that went for Donald Trump, but it tends to flip around back and forth. There was a primary there a week or so ago, and it appears that the likely strongest Republican candidate was nominated. Is that now one that's in the toss-up category?
Well, the most recent poll had that seat tied, and the Republicans did nominate a very strong candidate. Their sitting Attorney General Josh Hawley will be running against incumbent Claire McCaskill. McCaskill's mostly survived because she's had the fortune of having weak opponents. This is the first time I think she's faced a very strong top-tier Republican candidate. So it's going to be a very close race. Incumbents tend to have a little bit of an advantage. You know, they've got the name identification advantage. They've had 6, and in her case, 12 years to solidify support. But this is going to be a race that looks like it's going to go down to the wire.
We have been talking with Keith Naughton, who, as I mentioned, is principal of Silent Majority Strategies. He also writes frequently for The Daily Caller, where he recently had an opinion column talking about the upcoming races for the United States Senate. And there's a lot of detail in that column. Keith, if folks would like to read that column or learn more about your efforts, where can they go?
They can go to Daily Caller Opinion, the DC Opinion page, and you can see all of my work there and a lot of other great contributors.
Keith Naughton of the Daily Caller. Keith, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Between tariffs and renegotiation of international treaties, free trade has dominated the economic news in recent months. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Competitive Enterprise Institute Vice President Ian Murray, who says there's also a moral case for free trade. Eric?
So if you're like me, if you're somebody who describes themselves as a libertarian or a classical liberal or a conservative with some libertarian leanings, you probably thought that we had already won the debate over free trade. But we're now having to relitigate that debate. And we've been doing this now for several months because of some of the policies that President Donald Trump has implemented. And we are having this fight not just on economic grounds, but on political grounds. And as my guest is going to talk about today, on moral grounds as well. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Ian Murray. He is a vice president at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And he is one of the co-authors, along with Ryan Young, of a new report that CEI has out this week on the economic and, yes, moral benefits of trade. It's called Traders of the Lost Ark. That's the title, which, of course, a clever reference to Indiana Jones, and that certainly catches the eye of an Indiana Jones fan like myself. Ian, thanks for taking some time and being here on the show.
It's a delight to be with you.
So look, Ian, this is a short interview here. We only have a few minutes, but as succinctly as you can, lay it out for me. What's the moral case for free trade here?
Well, the fact is that we often talk about free trade as being between nations. That isn't the case. What free trade is individuals trading with each other. There just happens to be a border in the way. You know, it's no different from me walking down to the coffee shop downstairs and trading with Ben. The only difference is we have this border in the way, and for some reason, national governments have decided that this is a place where they can flex their muscles. They shouldn't. Individuals trade with each other, and we believe that the moral case is that governments should get out of the way.
In some ways, I keep thinking about the tariffs and Trump's defense of tariffs as almost like a leftover from a previous historical time. Way back when, it was much harder to collect taxes, so we did. We erected tariffs at ports and borders as a way to generate revenue for the government, but now it's kind of morphed into this protectionist tactic, and I guess that was always part of it, but that distinction kind of gets lost sometimes. The president has gestured towards this history, of course, and he's argued we could use tariffs more to help pay off the national debt or whatever as a revenue tactic. But really, his tariffs are about protectionism. And the world today is very different from the world of the 1790s or the 1820s.
Yeah, that's very much the case. I mean, the reason that Alexander Hamilton wanted tariffs was exactly, as you said, as a revenue-raising exercise in order to pay off the debt that the United States had assumed on behalf of the various states. If you look at a similar time in Britain, for instance, Britain was moving rapidly towards free trade because they'd seen the effects of the Napoleonic system during the Napoleonic Wars. And at the same time, David Ricardo, the great economist, was coming out with his principle of comparative advantage. And so they moved to free trade at the same time as America moved to protectionism. And Britain really reaped the benefits of that throughout the 19th century, whereas American industries were often very constrained by their problems. And there was a major falling out between the North and South before the Civil War over free trade. The South wanted free trade and the North didn't.
Yeah, and this is one of those things. We seem to see this repeated over and over again. Even today, when you look around the world, the countries that engage in more trade are the ones that are more prosperous. I mean, nobody wants to be Cuba, right? We isolated them as a punishment so that they couldn't trade with people, and it hurt them. So maybe this is something that's just, maybe it's so evident, it's all around us all the time, and maybe we've kind of forgotten the value of trade because we just sort of take it for granted.
Well, yes, I think what's happened is that since the signing of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade in the late 1940s, after the Second World War, for 60 years we've had this this period where tariffs have just been coming down time after time after time through trade, through various rounds of GATT, through various bilateral and multilateral trade deals around the world, so much so that tariffs haven't really been an issue between developed countries for a very long time. So we forget, we've just forgotten the problems that come with them. Virtually all economists agree that the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of the 1930s were a major factor in prolonging the Depression. We learned that in the 1940s. I hate to think that we're going to have to relearn that again today.
It looks very much like we may have to. We are talking to Ian Murray. He is the vice president at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., and the co-author of a new paper out this week about the economic and moral case for free trade. Ian, we don't have a lot of time left, but I can already hear the Trump fans out there yelling about China. Trump says China is killing us on trade. They're cheating on trade deals. They are, to be fair, a big, relatively new entrant into this world of global trade. They don't always play by the rules. And so supposedly Trump's tariffs are going to force them to change their behavior. Do you think this will work?
Well, it's a very blunt instrument the president's using. One of the main problems with China, and China is a really bad actor on trade, is that, for instance, China steals intellectual property from American companies. What would make sense is target those Chinese companies and public bodies that are stealing the intellectual property. China's trade is really a symptom of it being a communist dictatorship. You know, there are some market processes in China which are very welcome and have done great good for the Chinese people, but there's still an awful lot of central planning there and to the benefit of the leaders and their cronies. So what you really need to do is target those leaders and their cronies. And again, the tariff just targets everybody, even the good actors. So it, as I say, it's a very blunt instrument.
Yeah, targeting not just the good actors and bad actors in China, but of course, targeting lots of good and bad actors here in the United States as well. Lots of businesses are feeling the pain from Trump's tariffs. Ian, we could talk about this probably for another hour and not cover all of the economic and moral arguments for trade, but we really appreciate you taking some time here and trying to distill this down into a few minutes for us. Thanks for being here.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Eric.
And again, that is Ian Murray from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's a vice president over there, and he is the co-author of this new report, Traders of the Lost Ark. You can find that at CEI.org or just Google Traders of the Lost Ark. You'll find the paper there. It's a fascinating read. Check that out and check our coverage of tariffs out at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. We'll catch you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Property taxes are among the most hated types of taxation, and for good reason. So says Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
There is no other tax like the property tax. The property tax is levied against one type of asset, real property, which means your house or your business location. It is a tax on an asset, not income, and is an extraordinarily regressive tax. Virtually all other forms of taxes are based upon income, sales, usage, or an event taking place like death with the estate tax. With most other taxes, if your income goes down, your income taxes go down. If sales go down, sales tax goes down. If your usage goes down, tolls, gasoline taxes, excise taxes, they all go down. None of this is true with your property taxes. With property taxes, the government has a perceived insatiable source of funding because of the mere presence of your home or your business in the taxing jurisdiction. The more you improve your property's value, the greater the opportunity for government to spend because you have increased the value of your property and thereby increase the funds available for government to promise to others. Property taxes encourage government to make promises that they cannot possibly keep because they have your property to serve as collateral for government's promises. The U.S. Constitution addresses and protects property rights in yet so many ways. The founders valued property rights because those rights were denied in the economic systems of the time in Europe. Unfortunately, for those believing that the property tax is fair, there's a law of diminishing returns with this form of taxation. This means that while government can tax property in any way that it wants, there's a point in time in which the property will lose value because of the tax. When that happens, the economic system in the locality will fail, undermining the very government that put the tax into place in the first place. Recently, a realtor was explaining to me her frustration that a property located in one of our cities was virtually identical to a property only two blocks away but located in a different municipality, but was selling for $50,000 less than the equivalent property nearby. This means that the city homeowner not only pays the tax, but loses the value of their asset because of the tax. That's theft. Only by eliminating property taxes will the beast be tamed and liberty restored. Contrary to popular belief, the property tax system started in the United States dates at the time of the founding of our nation. The United States has often prided itself that we no longer have debtor prisons. Debtor prisons were, for the most part, outlawed in the United States by the end of the Reconstruction. While debtor prisons were commonplace in New England early in the formation of our nation, the entire idea of such prison was met with revulsion by most Americans. In a recession, or when you retire, you may lose your home due to the property tax, which is nothing more than theft of property by legislation and regulation. Those without significant financial resources are the most vulnerable. Today, property taxes as a means of taxation, and with the massive debt load in our states and our nation, have propelled us into becoming a debtor prison nation. The prison, however, is your home. Everyone with property is essentially under house arrest. Taxes on property have been debated incessantly for decades. What started out as an innocent means of raising taxes has blossomed into a perceived unlimited source of funds by which government can make promises of future benefits to a select few to the detriment of the remainder of us. Property owners have the choice of either paying the taxes dictated for them by politicians or risk losing their property through foreclosure and tax sale. If government were to tax all assets, including homes, the entire concept of property taxes would vanish in a nanosecond. You see, the rich have assets. Ask Warren Buffett or George Soros if they would support a tax on assets rather than income. The answer should not surprise you. The American dream of home ownership and the liberty inherent in property is being shattered by those elected to serve us all. It is time that we demand a control in government spending and an assessment of why property is taxed at all. It is not just property, it is your home. It is your liberty at stake. Company towns of the 19th century are being replaced by state towns or school towns in the 21st century unless we act to reform spending and return the right of property to the people. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WMBS AM and FM in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, KWFM FM in Wichita Falls, Texas, and WSBP LP in Woodbridge, New Jersey. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.